Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. There's a reason people who advise others on how to manage money are called financial planners. Financial stability, they say, all begins with a good plan. And that's true at any stage of life, whether you're just out of college or close to retirement, and all the more important in uncertain economic times. Joining me in the studio to talk about how to come up with and then follow a money management plan, Jane Bryant Quinn. Her new book is titled Making the Most of Your Money Now. She's a columnist for Newsweek magazine, The Washington Post, and Bloomberg.com. Good morning to you, Jane. Good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. I'm very happy to be here with you.
And Chris Farrell. He's the author of a new book called The New Frugality. He's a resident personal finance expert and economics editor for American Public Media's Marketplace Money. He's a contributing editor for Business Week magazine. Good to have you here, Chris.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Thank you. And to all of you, please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Jane, your best-selling book, Making the Most of Your Money, first published 20 years ago. You've revised it for the new economy. What are the most important things you're telling people now?
People need to be more concerned about their security than they were before. I think they know that after the panic of 2008 and the meltdown. But they still, even after the bust in 2000, they were not saving money. Now we're at the point where you're not going to get rich in the market and your house isn't going to make you rich. And we have chronic unemployment, maybe for some time. And saving money and getting your finances in order, there is nothing more important than that today. What have I got? How can I look to the future based on what I have now?
But Chris Farrell, you both are talking about saving more. But what do you say to people who are struggling so much and to so many American families who are barely making it?
Well, there are no easy answers, and it's very, you can come up with sort of glib answers. But, the thing is, people really still need to try and save over a period of time. It's not going to necessarily happen tomorrow, but there are all kinds of tricks of the trade that you can do, even if it's a little automatic savings coming out of your checking account into a savings account just a little bit. A lot of it is just trying to develop the habit of savings while you're struggling. There's not going to be much going there, but it's a mindset of borrowing less, spending less, and saving more.
How did we get out of the habit of saving?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. If you look at the whole post-World War II period, we would go into recessions, but after came out of a recession, we would borrow more. But if you look at the 70s, real household income grew 4.5%. The 80s, business expansion, real household income grew 6.5%. You go to the 90s, it was 8.3%. You go into the 2000s, it fell by 0.6%. So we moved into a different world. Plus, we just borrowed enormous amounts of money, unprecedented, and partially because we borrowed more, but also we were lent more, and we were really lent more. And what happened is people were trying to maintain their standard of living, but they weren't making the kind of money. So, we've always said we want to live within our means. Guess what? Over the next period of time, that's exactly what people are going to have to do.
If I can add something to that, and this goes to the automatic savings that Chris just mentioned. So many people who are living paycheck to paycheck, as you said, believe they cannot save because there's never any money at the end of the month. They're struggling. But the most amazing thing is that if you make saving automatic, if you're in a 401k, just say 5% of your money, or if you're working for yourself and you start an IRA at a bank or at a mutual fund and have 5% out of every paycheck, you will say to yourself in advance, I can't do that. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I'm stuck. If you do that, you will discover that you are still living paycheck to paycheck, but you are suddenly saving money. It is the only known miracle in personal finance that if you put aside something first, automatically, you will live on what's left. And I remember this happened to me in my early 20s when I wasn't actually saving money and I was working. And a friend came and said to me, Jane, are you putting money in the thrift plan? And I said, I can't. I have no money. I can't pay the dentist. I'm having all this. And I started putting, he said, actually, he called me an idiot, was what he said. He said, Jane, you are an idiot. Put it in. And I started putting it in. And it was the most amazing thing to me because my standard of living didn't change. It somehow picked up money that I didn't even know was leaking through my fingers. So I just urge people to try this automatic saving. It's amazing.
Chris.
Well, people can't see me nodding, but I'm nodding. And I agree wholeheartedly. And again, you know, you have to take advantage. You need to take advantage of that retirement savings plan, and particularly if your company is offering you a match. And I've gotten a number of emails and calls over people who are pressed, you know, and if they don't want to necessarily take advantage of the company match. I mean, first of all, you're cutting your pay. Secondly, you know, every single month, every single year, you are doing better than Warren Buffett can because of that match, that return that you're getting. It's an incredible thing. So again, I would just want to reiterate, automatic savings, not just retirement savings plans, but outside of it, because in today's online world, it's really easy to set up.
The problem is that with this low savings rate, people also got into the habit of borrowing. What happened, Chris?
Oh, well, you know, we talked, you know, there was a housing bubble. And it wasn't, you know, but it wasn't just housing. It was student loans. It was auto loans. And I was really stunned that in 2007, the about half of car loans were for 6 years. Now, that's just that's crazy to be taking out a 6-year loan on a depreciating asset on a car. And so it really spilled over to all aspects of our economy. Now, sometimes people are saying, well, when the economy recovers, and it will recover eventually, we're going to go back to the way it was before. And I just don't believe that because I don't think people are getting wage increases. I mean, how many people really believe they're going to be able to walk into the boss's office and say, give me a 5% raise or I'm walking? And they'll say, goodbye. Have a nice walk. You know, it's a very different environment. Housing's not going to recover very quickly. A quarter of all private college tuition was being paid for by home equity loans. You know, that's not available anymore. So this is really a transfer. This is a sea change in the way we're going to be managing our money.
But are you saying that people ought to only buy a car if they can pay cash for it?
No, but drive that car to the ground. That's what I am saying. You know why? You know, okay, so you buy a car. And I'm agnostic. Do you buy new? Do you buy used? I buy new because I don't understand cars. I know you put the ignition in and then you drive it off, but I don't understand them whatsoever. So I buy new and then you drive it into the ground. You know, you don't get into this perpetual leasing so you can buy a fancier car. You know, that's a land that's perpetual renting of a car. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can do that are actually pretty sensible that do save you money over time.
Do you agree with that?
I was just about to put in a word for used cars, Chris, because so with so many people leasing, cars come off a 2-year lease, and they're in absolutely wonderful condition. And in fact, you can put the key in the ignition and drive off. And they have various guarantees that come with them. So actually, I have twice bought a car off a lease, a used car, a 2-year-old car, and then subsequently driven it into the ground. So I do approve of that. But you should try not to take a car loan for any longer than you can actually intend to drive it. And that's a 3-4 year car loan at the max. But one other thing, too, I want to say about this borrowing, Diane, is that over the past 20 plus years, we have come to think of consumer debt as normal. Your mortgage was normal, your car loan was normal, then your student loan was normal. And all of a sudden we say, check, yes, having credit card debt is normal. That is not normal. This is where you are feeding your money to the squirrels when you are paying 18, 20, 24%. People say, I'm living paycheck to paycheck, and yet they're voluntarily paying 20% more for everything they buy by carrying it on a credit card. And people are understanding that. We're seeing this go down.
How did it become acceptable in the first place to carry all this debt and then to declare bankruptcy?
Because it became, first, so easy. Second, everyone was doing it, and we all have a herd mentality. Third, they make it, the banks made it so attractive. And then they started, of course, raising the fees and raising the price as it got deregulated. They deregulated fees in the middle of 1990s, and that was when the fees started leaping up. And what has happened? One of the things that worries me most, Diane, is not so much the younger people, because they're going to figure it out. They see what's happening to the older people. They don't want that to happen to them. But people who are 55, 60, who suddenly, they have been in debt all their lives. They are carrying debt into their retirement. Mm-hmm. We are having much more mortgage debt, more consumer debt being carried by people who suddenly don't have paychecks anymore. And if you kind of roll that forward, I don't want to sound like gloom and doom, but it is. We are seeing sharply rising bankruptcies among people in their 70s and their 80s. Mm-hmm. And that's because they're 55, 60 with too much debt, lose their paycheck, and they can't get out of it. And this is an object lesson for younger people. Don't get into this bind.
Oh, just to echo this, I mean, one of the worst pieces of financial advice that became almost conventional wisdom was to go into your retirement years with the mortgage, that was actually a smart thing to do. And, you know, without a mortgage is the foundation of being in retirement. In fact, being without debt is the foundation of being in retirement, because you have an awful lot of flexibility. You really do, because just as when you're working, there's going to be fluctuations in your circumstances and in your expenses. And if you don't have debt in retirement, you really do have your own safety net.
Chris Verhul, he's the author of a new book, The New Frugality. He is economics editor for Marketplace Money, contributing editor for Business Week magazine. Jane Bryant Quinn is here as well. Her new book, Making the Most of Your Money Now. Welcome back. Two wonderful, thoughtful people with financial understanding are with me. Jane Bryant Quinn. She is a columnist for Newsweek magazine, The Washington Post, and Bloomberg.com. Her own website is janebryantquinn.com. Chris Verhul is with me. He is the economics editor for Marketplace Money, contributing editor for Business Week magazine, the author of The New Frugality. Do join us. I look forward to hearing from you. Here's an email from Janet, who says, "My husband and I, like many others, saved as much as we could, putting savings into Roth, IRAs, TDAs, CDs. We lived frugally, well under our means. With all our years of saving, we now feel betrayed by the financial industry. We believed in investing in stocks and bonds. Now that we're ready to retire, what are our options?" Chris.
Well, there's a lot of people that are going to agree exactly with what she's saying. And people do feel betrayed. There's nothing, everything about a bailout stinks. that we just went through, except for the alternatives, which would be even worse. I think that the main thing that they've been saving, and they've been saving certificates of deposit and the various retirement savings accounts, it sounds like they have a conservative framework there.
But the stock market
absolutely let them down. And one of the real problems that happened with savings is that savings, I think, was hijacked 3 decades ago with retirement savings plans, and was really hijacked by Wall Street, and it became all about stocks and bonds, and less about the freedom of choice that savings gives you throughout a lifetime to sort of fund different transitions in your life, of which retirement or going into your older years is one of those transitions. That said, that's the pension plan that we have. That's the pension plan that people have to deal with. And in terms of the stock market, there what I would be at this point in their life is be opportunistic and to sort of say, okay, if this is more risk than we should be taking, and it sounds like it is, be opportunistic and make themselves more conservative. But from the way she's phrased her question, unlike some people who walked into their elderly years with, say, maybe 70% in stocks, the way the question is phrased, they don't sound like they're in that circumstance. They're going to wait it out.
I think that it's very important for people to understand that, first, stocks eventually will come back. Second, they should...
You still believe that,
I do,
Jay.
Believe that. Yes, I do. And second... First, I guess I have two things. First, what is the option? You don't want to be entirely in CDs or entirely in bonds for the next 40 years because inflation and taxes will eat you up. So if you have a 15 or 20-year horizon, as you still do when you are young going into retirement, there still needs to be an allocation between stocks and bonds because you're going to need the stocks for longer-term growth. But do not buy individual stocks. Nobody, none of us are. We are all amateurs. I don't buy individual stocks. How do you know what a company is doing? Look at all of the people who own these famous banks, widows and orphans stocks, and suddenly the banks are broke. AIG, global big insurance company, that's broke. You cannot know what a company is going to do. So you should be absolutely first in stock-owning mutual funds, and second, even more, you should be in index funds that follow the market. There is not one single managed mutual fund that has outdone the market over a 15 or 20-year period. Not one. And that tells me that if you were trying to guess which is the best stock fund manager, you were leaving money on the table.
Oh, I'd absolutely agree. I mean, quite frankly, I just think you buy the total stock market index. You just buy all the publicly traded U.S. companies, and you're participating in the U.S. economy. If the U.S. economy does well and we have some corporate profits, you'll do well. If the U.S. economy isn't, you're not going to do that well. And I think really, Jane and I agree, it's part of it is what's the emphasis that you're looking on. I think that there was a period of time where there was too much emphasis on how much money can I make during my retirement from the stock market and less emphasis on savings. And I have just a slight emphasis, it's kind of like you kind of want to have an approach of, okay, what's my minimum standard of living? What's the bottom line that I don't want to go below? But then you still have to take, and I still think there are really good reasons for taking risk in the stock market above that, and you want to participate in the growth of this U.S. economy, and it provides protection against inflation. But again, just do the whole thing.
But think about all the individuals who got onto their computers and were day trading, were just... picking stocks, moving in, moving out. What happened there, Jane?
Well, that was not a smart thing for them to do, as we have clearly seen. And by the way, there's something new coming up with this that I've had lots of questions on. This is currency trading. The same people who were day trading are now, because you can get them online and people are saying, how much money you can make, they're going into currency trading. This is just nuts. This is not the way to behave if what you are looking for is a long-term gain on your money.
If you're talking about index funds, what about money managers? How many people need money managers, financial directors, people to turn to say, should we be doing this? Should we be doing that? What kind of advice?
I think most people should do it on their own. I mean, if you think about most people's finances, they own their own home. They have some savings with a bank, money market mutual fund, that kind of thing. And then there's a retirement savings plan. And basically, you know your circumstances better than a lot of other people. We're the expert, and I think as far as professional money managers, you're adding to the cost, and it's very rare that they are going to give you a return for that. Now, there's certain types of things like the U.S. tax code, where I do think it does make sense for many people to hire experts because our circumstances can get very complicated, and an expert really can actually save you some money in terms of the taxes. So there is an example of an expert I would believe in. Most money managers, really what you're just doing is adding to your fees, and fees compound over time, just like returns.
I would absolutely recommend, however, especially people who are just retiring, to see a financial planner, but specifically a fee-only financial planner. A fee-only financial planner is someone who does not sell products, does not take commissions, charges fees for his or her advice. And at retirement in particular, when you have a corpus of money that says, this is basically what I'm going to have for the rest of my life, how do I stretch it out? What kind of spending can I afford? What's my tax situation? What choices should I make if I'm rolling money out of a 401k?
But is that a one-time thing you're talking about?
It can be a one-time thing, or two visits, just to get a look at what you... I think everybody can benefit from this. But I stress fee only, because if you go to someone who sells products, they're going to sell you an expensive tax-deferred annuity or something like that. You don't want it. There are two places to look. The Garrett Planning Network, .com is financial fee-only planners that deal with middle classes primarily, and the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, NAPFA.org. They have, some of them are wealth managers, but many of them also deal with middle-class people, and these are two organizations that are fee-only planners, and you should look them up on the web and see if they're near you.
Do you want to add to that, Chris?
Oh, I just would absolutely agree. I mean, there is that point of time. That is a major transition in your life, and what the fee-only financial planner, which they will also take a broad look. So they also include everything. You know, a lot of times people call themselves financial planners, and what they know is the stock market, or they pick stocks, or they know life insurance. And the advantage of a fee-only financial planner, and I would go with one with a broad designation like a certified financial planner, they're more expensive, but they'll look at the broad, all your assets, what you have, what's going on, and it really helps you. It gives you a guidepost.
And what is a reasonable fee for those financial planners? It's usually a percentage of wealth, is it not?
If they manage your money for you, if you say, I don't want to manage it, you do it.
Yeah.
It is 1% or less. Basically, it's, you know, 0.6 to 1%. However, many of these managers will simply give you advice for the hour, and they may charge something like $350, $400 an hour. So if you spend 2 or 3 hours with them for 2 or 3 days, that would be your total cost. And from there, and they'll advise you on long-term care insurance, they'll advise you on all of these other things, and then you can pick up and follow that plan on your own.
By the way, just a small thing, one thing for you adult children thinking about what can you do for your parents or nearing their retirement or in the early years of retirement, pay for them to go to a fee-only financial planner. It's a wonderful gift that can help them out.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Jeff. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a kind of complex question, but my wife and I have been steadily paying down credit card debt, personal debt. We paid off a car last year, and over the past 18 months, we've really retired a lot of debt. We still have a credit card with about 7.9% interest and another one with 10.9% interest. So we're trying to pay those off. My question is, should we, and we've stopped contributing to our own 403B investment. My workplace invests in it as well, but I've stopped our individual contributions so that we could pay down that debt. My question is that the best route to take? Kind of setting savings aside until the debt's paid off. Do you do both? And then there's the temptation of a rising market and wanting to get into what might look like a good investment on the stock market.
Chris Farrell.
Well, the one thing I would do is avoid the temptation of a rising stock market. It's always that lure of, and part of it is just sort of the warning bells. And you're probably not doing this, but that's sort of like you get out of it, and then you get into it, and then you get out of it. And so I tend to be, you know, we've heard this expression, all the old rules no longer apply. I actually think all the old rules were devised during the Great Depression. They were devised in the 1970s. They came around for good reasons, which is that for most of us, buy and hold and then making modest adjustments is the way to go. So you want to get back into the equities? Why? And is this going to be, is this, does this make sense for you, part of your portfolio? In terms of the 403B, one quick question back is there a match with that 403B?
No, my employer just puts in 11% of my salary.
Okay. So that's still going into the 403B? No.
Oh, from my employer, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a supplemental that I was contributing to, but we stopped it to pay off the debt.
Oh, well, then that, okay, then that changes exactly what I was going to say just then, which is I think you're doing great. Bravo. Congratulations. I hope that everybody listening to the show takes a lesson from you.
Paying off the debt.
He's paying off the debt, but he's still 11%.
Yeah.
He's still participating in the retirement savings plan. Bravo.
And if he did not have that 11%, I think Chris and I both would have said, no, put part of your money at least into retirement savings. So for those people who may have stopped it and don't have a company match and don't have it going in, say to them, please, please do both. Don't completely give up your retirement savings. Say do part of it there and part of it paying down your debt. But for Jeff, he's golden.
Jane Bryant Quinn and her new book, Making the Most of Your Money Now. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Atlanta, Georgia. Good morning, Adelia. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have two questions, actually, and they are about credit card debt. I'm a part of the 11% who is unemployed, and I've been very recently married, and right now we're living on one income. We have some pretty large, we have like three credit cards, and one has a really, really high interest rate. My first question is, we want to start paying them down, but where do you start? Do you start with the smallest one and just pay the minimum on the high interest rate one, or do you start with the high interest rate one? My second question is about, I heard at some point that if you have a credit card with really high interest rate, you can call the credit card company sometimes and either somehow work it so that you don't have to pay such so high of an interest rate. So I'm just wondering how you can go about doing that with the credit card companies.
Chris.
Well, a couple things. In terms of calling the credit card companies, that used to be a standard piece of advice. That was when they were, you know, we always had a thing, you go to the mailbox and there's solicitations. They're not doing it these days. Instead, what they're doing is they're cutting lines of credit, they're closing accounts. The whole environment with the credit cards has changed. As far as the, which one do you attack? Well, mathematically, you attack the highest rate credit card first, all right? And then you work your way down. However, and I think that's the best way to go. However, it can sometimes make sense if you got a, you know, maybe what your one of your low rate cards is not that big a debt. And, you know, we all like accomplishing something because sometimes you can end up in this cycle where you're just, all you feel like you're doing is paying down debt and you're making some progress, but you never get there. So psychologically, you feel good because you attack that low credit card debt and you got rid of it fairly quickly. And that gives you that incentive to keep going. Fine. But mathematically, I go for the high rate first.
Jane?
I would agree with that. But I also want to add to Adelia, please stop using your credit cards because you're not going to get anywhere if you're paying down, but then using your credit cards for more. So swear them off. You know, put them in your freezer. Freeze them in a
use cash.
Board. Stop. Or use a debit card. Use cash. Stop using those credit cards. Or your paying off is not going to do any good if you're putting in more at the other end.
Good luck to you, Adelia. And here's a call from Jason in Elkhart, Indiana. You're on the air.
Yeah, my problem is that, I mean, I've honestly lived almost completely debt-free, everything in cash. I'm buying my house on a land contract. I go to get a mortgage, and the banks tell me that they can't give me a mortgage because I have no revolving credit. I don't have a credit card. In today's society, if you don't hold a credit card, you don't use a lot of credit, irregardless of what you do, they're not going to give you a loan. I have a very good savings rate. I have money. I have a life insurance, a whole life policy. I have an IRA. And as a lower income individual in a household with a disabled individual, our household income is very low, and I still manage to save between 20% and 40% of my income.
Wow. Good for you, Jane.
And by the way, that reminds back to an earlier question where you used people living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
Here is somebody with a very modest income, and he is still saving money. Unfortunately, it is true nowadays that if you want to get a loan, you're going to have to prove that you have paid off a revolving credit. So I guess I have to tell you, much as you hate it, get a credit card, get one that doesn't charge a fee, you know, charge a few things that you know, whatever your expenses are, you know, put them on the card and pay it off at the end of the month. I wish that weren't so. I wish they would just look at people's total financial situation. But the truth is they don't. You do need a credit card with a credit history.
This might be a little bit of a Hail Mary pass, but also depending on what he does, going to a credit union, if it's tied into his industry or his business or his employer, there may be an opportunity there.
Chris Farrell, The New Frugality, and Jane Bryant Quinn, Making the Most of Your Money Now. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
In the 1960s, math genius Ed Thorpe came up with a way to win at blackjack. He wrote a book about it, then set his sights higher.
And the biggest casino in the world appeared to me to be Wall Street.
Thorpe's ideas revolutionized the stock market. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Thorpe and with Scott Patterson, author of the new book, The Quants. Join us.
We're back with your calls, your questions, comments for Chris Farrell. You hear him on Marketplace, and he's a regular contributor to Business Week magazine. Jane Bryant Quinn writes for Newsweek, The Washington Post, Bloomberg.com. Her new book, Making the Most of Your Money Now. We'll go now to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Good morning again. My comment is this. I live in an area that was economically depressed long before the present recession started. A lot of industry has left. A lot of people lost good-paying jobs. Their opportunities for employment are in the service industry, and often what they face is temporary work. They don't have stable incomes. Many of them would aspire to live paycheck to paycheck because they don't know from week to week or month to month if they're going to have a paycheck. How do you plan, save, or live when you are in a completely unstable financial situation and you don't know what's going to happen next week.
Chris.
Well, you know, the answers are easy. Living through the circumstances can be very difficult. But there are a lot of people who actually live that kind of a life. And traditionally, freelancers, artists, all kinds of folks out there have very unstable incomes. And one of the advantages of the world that we live in today is that there actually are some fairly useful tools that help you smooth things out. Because in a sense, but you have to be really responsible to your money. So you're going to essentially try and pay yourself a salary. As you smooth out your income over time, you're going to simply have to try and save more. You can use, you know, some of the online savings accounts in order to set aside some money. In good times, you're going to have to set up an IRA for yourself. Your employer's not going to do it for you, more than likely. Some temp companies will do it for you, but usually they don't. And then, of course, you always have the big question mark about healthcare. And how are you paying for your healthcare expenses? At this point, I've probably just, you know, gone through a whole lot of things and people are going, what can I do? But the thing is, as Jane was saying and that caller earlier, you know, people can set aside more money than they think. If this is the situation that you're in and that's what you're doing, is to try and smooth out your income over time, to pay yourself an income over time. When you do get a project, when you do get some money in, you just can't, you're going to have to smooth that out.
Here's an interesting email from Anne. She says, I've never been in debt, and for the fairly low salary I earn, I've been able to save about $40,000 in addition to an IRA. I also live within my means. I've never owned a home. I've always rented. I have people telling me now is a great time to buy a house, but the thought seems pretty scary considering what's happened in the housing market. Since I am 45, I am wondering if buying a home is still considered the avenue to wealth. Jane.
Buying a home is not the avenue to wealth at this point. Do you know, before the housing bubble that we just had, 97 to 2007, homes for years, the prices basically went nowhere. They went up a little following the inflation rate, a little higher, a little lower. But for years and years and years, people actually did not think of their homes as an investment. They thought of them as a nice place to live, and if they're lucky, they would get an equity kicker. And we are going back to that time. I do not expect house prices to rise rapidly at all in the future. I think we're going back to this time when it's a nice place to live. And so unless you have a strong reason to want a backyard and to have all of the expenses, you know, a house is very expensive to take care of, you know, cleaning the gutters, fixing the roof, always something goes wrong. A house is a money pit. So there is no reason to buy it for investment, I don't believe, going forward. You would buy it as a lifestyle. And if you like that lifestyle, it's a great time to buy. But if you're buying it for investment, I would say no.
Chris.
You know, two of the biggest lies in the real estate industry, and there's a lot of competition for that. One is borrow as much as you can to buy as big a house as you can, and renting is throwing your money away. Both are just wrong. So on a financial, just really echoing what Jane's saying, on a financial basis, I would just compare what's the price of rent versus the price of home ownership or a condo in your area. And see, you know, really run the numbers. And in many places, you're still going to come out ahead renting. And the other thing is, it is really a lifestyle choice. And it's not an investment return. Robert Shiller, Mr. Bubble, Yale University, love him. You know, he makes an argument that over the past 100 years, the real return on real estate has been about zero. His colleague, Carl Case, disagrees, says, nah, it's about 1.5% to 2.5%. All right. So, yes, we all know people who made a lot of money in real estate. We all do. But most people don't.
And furthermore, that was the bubble. That was a time when amateurs could make money, only amateurs. Yeah. And many, many long-term studies, again, echoing what Chris has said, stocks do better than real estate over the long run, which is very hard for people to believe. But that's a fact.
To Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. When I was a kid, my mother was a real estate agent, and when I got my first driver's license, my family job was to chauffeur her. And her colleagues used to hammer into me time and time again two rules, and you've answered the first one. The first one was basically a house is not an investment, it's a hedge against inflation. But the second rule was you should always strive to buy the least expensive house that you can find in the best, or which translates into the most expensive neighborhood or street. Could you please comment on that second rule?
The second rule is fine by me. I mean, yeah. Because if you're in a, if you have a least expensive house, that would presume that you can do something to it to fix it up and bring it up to speed in the neighborhood. But I do want to point out that if you do nothing to the house, it will remain the least expensive house in the neighborhood, so that when you sell it, you won't get what you think. So buying the least expensive house usually means that this is a fix-up and you're going to have to put another a lot of cash into it. So I would take a long look at that rule. I love the first rule. I take a long look at the second rule.
And the other thing I would like to just sort of now just take a slight twist, because he sounds too young for this, but for downsizing. And that, you know, there is that rule about the smallest house in an expensive neighborhood. But I also think for a lot of people, we were talking earlier about having a mortgage in retirement and what a bad idea that is. I think for many people, it also does make sense to downsize to a smaller place, because you not only are saving in terms, hopefully you don't have a mortgage, but the maintenance costs are much less, the property taxes are less. There's just a lot of savings that actually compound, and it can be a very smart move to downsize your home.
Here's an email from Manimi, who says, I am 49 years old. My credit card debt equals my 401k savings. I am living paycheck to paycheck, paying this debt, and cannot get it paid. Should I use my 401k to pay it off?
No.
No, no,
no. Do not do that. And I don't know how you got into this amount of debt.
You're fined if you take out that 401k, are you not?
Well, there's a
taxes.
There's a penalty, there's taxes, and this is your future. And I'm a huge believer in paying your debts and being a good citizen and all of that, but I'm going to say something that will probably startle people. If you are absolutely in over your head, where it is impossible, given your paycheck, to pay the debts that you have run up for whatever reason, I would go bankrupt before I hit my 401k, because your 401k is the future.
And but bankruptcy, how can you do that, Jane? I mean, there is a question here, it seems to me, and maybe this is old-fashioned, of morality. If you bankrupt yourself, your debtors do not get paid, whereas you have saved your own money.
I agree with that. There is a question of morality, but there's also a question of what the bankruptcy law is for. It was designed to give people a second chance. And if some people are heavily in debt because of medical reasons, there are lots of reasons. Medical is now the leading cause of bankruptcy,
medical debt.
So I don't know. Maybe this caller simply, Manimi, maybe she just overspent, and you know, and it's a terrible thing to do, to say stiff your debtors at this point. It is still meant for second chances. You should do everything you can to pay it off. You should see a credit counselor. You should enter these various programs to try to pay off your debt. But if it becomes impossible, if you tap your 401k, you don't have a future for
yourself. Tell me about the law here. Is the 401k exempt from bankruptcy?
It is. It is exempt. There are certain things that are not. For example, student loans are not. But yes, I mean, student loans you have to pay off. You can't discharge them. Your asset in terms of retirement is safe. But here's the thing, and this is what I would really encourage her to think through, is whatever extreme action you take, a lot of times what happens when people tap into their 401k, where they cash it in or they borrow against it to pay off credit card debt, what happens a year or two later? Are you back in credit card debt? How did you get into this circumstance? Because whether you go into bankruptcy, whatever action you take, you got to figure out what's going on, because otherwise you're going to be back in the same situation relatively quickly.
Here's an interesting email from Carol, who says, I'm 62. I've saved money for 40 years, representing many vacations I didn't take, even lunches and evenings out. Most of that money went into safe, well-diversified retirement investments. Some went into improving our home. Now the retirement account is worth 40% less and the house 25% less than 3 years ago. And I am still working and not taking vacations or lunches. If I had it to do over again, I would not have saved that money at the expense of living my life, only to lose it now when I need it. And I can't get back either the money or the life. That's a sad commentary.
Well, you know, if she had spent more of it and saved less, she would have even less going into her retirement than she does now.
It's
although
true.
I certainly agree that some of your money has to go for your life. You can't give up your whole life for that. But something else, you know, I don't know how she invested her retirement account, but you never put it all in the stock market. And there's kind of a rule of 110. It says subtract your age from 110, and what is left, the number you get is the amount of money you might prudently put into a stock-owning
Say
index fund.
Say that again, Jay.
Subtract your age from 110. If you're 60, subtract it from 110, and you get the number 50. That means that you might prudently put 50% of your money in stock-owning index funds and the other 50% in bond funds. So if you use this rule of 110, that gives you some idea of how you should be diversifying your money. And if it's all in stocks when you're 60, that's the wrong thing. And if it were half in bonds, instead of having being 40% less, it would be worth only 20% less because the bonds would have been her cushion.
You know, it is always a balancing act. I mean, it just is. But I think it is her home, she's still living there. So she still has that. And hopefully it has been giving her a lifestyle that she wants and a neighborhood that she wants. So even though it's down in value, it's there.
Chris Farrell, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Worcester, Massachusetts. Good morning, Marco.
Hello, Miss. This question goes to the gentleman. Do you think the upside down trading should be eliminated? And could you tell the listeners what it is? Explain to them what it is. That way, they understand how to avoid it.
Upside down trading.
I'm mystified.
I don't. You know, you got me on that one.
What do you mean, Marco, by upside down trading?
When they, let's say, for instance, in vehicles, they come in, they owe $11,000 on the vehicle.
Cars. Oh, this goes back to one of the things Chris was saying about how you're taking something like a 6-year auto loan, or you're taking auto lease for this period, and then you want to come in, and after 3 years, you want to trade it in, but you are now, quote, upside down, meaning that you owe more on the car than is worth. And then if you go and take a new lease or take a new loan, now you are adding what you owed on the old car to what you are now going to owe on the new car. And so your debt gets bigger and bigger, and so that is nuts. So you should never, you should not have a loan or for a longer period of time than you're going to drive the car.
And finally, to DeBerry, Florida. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. My question is this. I am in credit card debt, drowning in credit card debt with the interest rate to 26 plus. I have two credit cards, have a mortgage. I also have a home that I rent. My renters have, of course, they have not worked in over a year, which means they basically are not paying rent, $200 or $300 here and there or something to that effect. But in the meantime, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. The rent money from the rent was actually supplementing my income to just to live. So I don't have any excess money. And I've just resorted to, I only pay one of the credit cards. The other, I am paying like $100 here, $100 there. Should I just forget about paying the $100? Is that a mistake, or do you have any suggestions?
Chris.
Well, one suggestion I have, because there's a lot going on here, is there's this organization, National Foundation for Credit Counselors, NFCC.org. There's a lot of scamsters out there in the whole credit management, credit counseling business. This is a legitimate organization. They're all around the country. They have seen everything. and they're not going to be able to deal with all your circumstances, but that may be a good way to get a sense of what your options are.
Last word, Jane.
I would also take a look at your rental property, because you may be spending money or losing money on this for years and years, and maybe you should just figure out how to sell and get out of it. There are a lot of people in this situation, but you know, if you have tenants that not paying the rent and you're paying the mortgage, you've got to get out of that property.
There is so much more to say, and at some point we'll devote 2 hours to taking care of your money. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Jane Bryant Quinn, her new book, Making the Most of Your Money Now. You can reach her through janebryantquinn.com. Chris Farrell, you hear him on Marketplace Money. His new book is titled The New Frugality. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.